This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. For the past several years, the world has watched the civic and economic disintegration of the African nation of Zimbabwe under the rule of dictator Robert Mugabe. Our guest, Peter Thornycroft, is one of the few independent journalists who's watched the events from inside Zimbabwe. Thornycroft was born and raised in the country when it was the white-ruled nation of Rhodesia. She continued to report on the country's crisis after foreign journalists were expelled, renouncing her British citizenship in 2001 to remain in Zimbabwe. Thornycroft has just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. Robert Mugabe was the leader of one of two black rebel groups that took power from a white supremacist government in 1980. Mugabe soon eliminated his internal opposition and established himself as Zimbabwe's ruler, though the country still goes through the formality of elections. Zimbabwe's current crisis has its root in a sweeping confiscation of white-owned farms that began in 2000. Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party initiated the campaign in part to punish an opposition movement led by Morgan Tsvangirai. As the country's agricultural economy collapsed, inflation soared. I spoke to Pina Thornycroft last week and asked her why food, fuel, and other necessities have become so scarce in Zimbabwe lately.
In June, the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, Christopher Dell, made a statement that Zimbabwe's rampant inflation would totally collapse the economy by year end. The military, who really run President Robert Mugabe and run policy, got a real panic. They interpreted this as a Western plot to effect regime change. That's what they say. And so they immediately set up a price task force and they froze prices as of June the 18th. With about 8,000% inflation, that's at the official rate, it meant that within a few days, prices for retail goods were 50% below the cost of production. The supermarkets were faced with no local goods. There were still some imported goods in some of the upmarket supermarkets, but really 99.999% of people can't afford to buy those goods. In the regular supermarkets throughout the country, the following items were missing: cooking oil, margarine, butter, sugar, flour, meat, excepting a little bit of pork, bread, and all dairy products. So all the basic essentials for nutrition were missing. There were some fruit and vegetables, and it took about 3 weeks before the black market clicked in. Zimbabwe has an extremely efficient black market, both for money and for goods that are in short supply. And so the black market started to get over, but I would say that 80% of the population were excluded from buying on the black market because they simply couldn't afford it.
So it does sound like an economic collapse. Let me ask, how do you get food and household goods that you need when you're there?
Because I earn foreign currency. I take essentials with me to Zimbabwe. I hardly ever travel with things like clothes. I've always got bottles of cooking oil and melting margarine in my suitcase and spilling yogurts in my suitcase and powdered milk and tinned meats and biscuits and things like that. I take things up with me. And then, because I have access to foreign currency, I hang around and listen as to where there might be some meat available, where there might be some essentials, and you pare down your diet. You just cut all essentials out.
Well, let's talk about how we got here. I mean, what President Mugabe will say is that, you know, a few years back, he took the bold step of redistributing the country's resources from wealthy whites to disenfranchised blacks, in effect, nationalizing industries and taking over farms. Why did this lead to the collapse of Zimbabwe's economy?
Commercial agriculture had always produced 40% of foreign currency, and that was produced by agricultural exports, grown 95% by white commercial farmers because they had the training and the resources to do it, and they were really good at what they did. And a new political party arose in September 1999, and fought a referendum in February 2000 in which the farm workers, mobilized to an extent by their employers, who represented the largest voting bloc in Zimbabwe, delivered Mugabe his first political defeat in February 2000 and rejected this new constitution. And Mugabe then turned on the farmers. There had been simmering. There were requests by people for more land. The land resettlement program since independence had not been a great success. So there was this discontent. There were no jobs in the manufacturing sector, few jobs in the business sector. Mugabe needed something to give people, to perhaps as all politicians do, and he chose to do it in two ways, to stop the opposition's support, massive support from the farm workers and the white farmers who had the resources to assist the opposition party, and to distribute that land, first of all, to landless people, but largely the main, best, richest, well-endowed first world farms were given to members of his cabinet, the military, the judges, senior civil servants, the police, anyone he needed
his
in
cronies,
order
in effect,
to maintain the status quo.
Once the farms are confiscated, I mean, it doesn't necessarily follow that changing ownership would lead to a collapse of production. Why did the change of ownership of these farms lead to such a widespread economic decline?
I think, first of all, that Mugabe never intended it to go as far as it did, actually. It developed a life of its own. Secondly, the people who took the farms, the white farmers, had made it look so easy. You drove past their farms, everything was neat and clipped, and the maize was all at the right same height. It looked so easy. I think they had no idea of the difference between growing some corn around a small patch of land in your communal area and growing, you know, vast acreages of land in a first world context where you have to raise money from the banks and do it in a first world way. And they just did not have that experience. They had not been trained for it. And they didn't realize that it was a full-time job. And this is not to say they're not some excellent farmers, who did take farmland that Mugabe gave them and are producing well, but they're in a tiny minority. We suspect that of all the 20 million acres taken for redistribution, less than 10% of it has been productively used.
We're speaking with journalist Peeta Thornycroft. She is a citizen of Zimbabwe and reports on that country for the London Daily Telegraph, The Voice of America, and other publications. Let's talk a bit about the political situation. I mean, Mugabe, of course, was a leader of a guerrilla movement, ZANU, one of two, which struggled against the white minority government and succeeded, and as he has been in power since 1980, has increasingly imposed restrictions on opposition. What is the level of political expression that is allowed in Zimbabwe today? Can one hold a political meeting? Can one publicly criticize the president?
You can hold a political meeting if you apply to the police for permission, and if the police give that permission, and then even if they do, they may break it up. That is his two weekly independent newspapers, which have a tiny circulation in the cities only. They never get out there. The four radio stations are controlled by the government. The only daily newspapers are controlled by the government, and even they don't get distributed in the rural areas because people are too poor to buy them. So there's virtually no political activity excepting that run and controlled by Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF.
And those who stage public protests are greeted often with arrests or, beatings, torture, right?
90% of those people who stage demonstrations, which get smaller and smaller every year, are arrested, and a majority of them are beaten by police when they're arrested, sometimes to within an inch of their lives, and sometimes one of them's just died from the march beatings. Yes, you cannot hold demonstrations. People do. They dart into the street for 35 seconds, get whacked over the head, and they dart back a month later. And the women of Zimbabwe Arise regularly hold meetings, and when the police come for them, they sit down, they get taken off to police stations, they do or they don't get beaten up. There's no civil protest allowed, endured, or even really taking place.
You've written several pieces about this group that you mentioned, the Women of Zimbabwe Arise. Who are they, and just tell us a little bit about their activities.
They're a group of civil society activists who want democracy. They're led by mostly women from the second city, Bulawayo. That's where it started. And they are pacifists. They will not ever resort to violence or hit back if, or even physically protest if they're being beaten. They just sit there and allow them, rather in the Gandhi tradition, they just sit there and allow themselves to be beaten and arrested.
Now there is a parliament in Zimbabwe, right? And there are actually opposition members of the parliament, right? Just talk a little bit about what the opposition is like. I mean, I gather that there's a movement which is divided. What are the prospects for an effective opposition to Mugabe?
They came so close in 2000 to winning a parliamentary majority. They will tell you that they didn't win those four seats. They were short of a parliamentary majority because of violence and vote rigging. I think there was less vote rigging, certainly violence, in 2000. When it came to the presidential election in 2002, the elections, to an extent, were just a joke. In 2005, at the general election for parliamentary seats, the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, had tragically split into two factions. And they'd lost their heart, their organization, their whatever it was, and they'd lost a third of their seats in those elections. And they rarely count for very little in the public life of Zimbabwe or any life in Zimbabwe. However, they made enough of an impact that they are now engaged in negotiations with the ruling ZANU-PF in secret talks facilitated by South African President Thabo Mbeki, who wants an end, finally, he wants an end to the crisis in Zimbabwe, and he wants the next elections due in March 2008 to be undisputed. That's what his words were, undisputed elections.
And as you look at the opposition figures, do you see a leader or a movement that you could see at some point bringing a successful transition to democracy and a hope for honest and responsible government?
There are great heroes in both factions of the divided Movement for Democratic Change, and there are great heroes amongst civil society activists in the civil rights movement. So far, they're plagued with a number of things, not least being infiltration by ZANU-PF, who've played a very clever role in assisting to divide the party. I think this generation of opposition activists may pass on, you know, and perhaps become elder statesmen, because they seem exhausted at the moment, because it's been seven long years. The efforts to get the two sides together have failed. I'm quite sure they failed because ZANU-PF managed to rouse opposition to the deal that had been put together for an
ZANU-PF
election
being,
pact.
Just for the audience, ZANU-PF, that's the Mugabe's party, right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. ZANU-PF is Mugabe's party. So all these efforts, there's just an exhaustion, really, and both parties, and one party has got access to resources. God knows where it gets its resources, but it's got access to resources. The other opposition faction hasn't got anything at all. So I don't even know how they'll get enough money to go to nomination court and register candidates for the next election.
Well, I wanted to talk a bit about your life. I mean, you grew up in this country when it was Rhodesia. Can you just say a little bit about, you know, your family, what it did for a living, kind of how your place in Rhodesian society when you were young?
I grew up on the border of Zimbabwe and Mozambique in a very wild part of the country. My family, my mother, and the rest of my family, we lived in the bush. They commuted across terrible roads to town and ran a small transport business.
Uh-huh.
And we had a very rural childhood, very happy, contented, quite poor rural childhood, where we lacked for nothing, really, apart from more sophisticated material goods. But we had a wonderful childhood. And we grew up and, this eldest son went into his father's business and I went away. I was the one who went away, but the rest of the family more or less went into the family business. And then, of course, there was the war.
You married and moved to South Africa, is that right?
I did.
Did you always regard Zimbabwe or Rhodesia as your home?
Yes, I did.
Tell me a little bit about what what you love about this country? I mean, what is it you miss when you're away?
It's incredibly beautiful. I mean, you've got images probably in America of Kenya and the Great Plains of Kenya. Everything in Zimbabwe is better. It's so beautiful. Its natural resources have been well cared for. The people are so incredibly gentle, which is to their disadvantage at the moment. It's an incredibly nice place. It was very advanced in Africa over alternative energy. It had the best educated population in Africa, and that's thanks to Mugabe. And good foundations, in fact, laid down by the British so that, unlike South Africa, where there was unequal education, any blacks who managed to get education had the same education as whites. So with independence, that education expanded massively. The healthcare expanded massively. It seemed that it was the jewel of Africa fulfilling its destiny. And then, unfortunately, in just 2 years after independence, Mugabe started his tribal and ethnic purge in the south of the country against the then opposition. But it is a very moral society. Those morals are breaking down along with the financial collapse. But it's a very safe society. I am still, to this day, safer in a high-density area in Harare than I would be in Johannesburg. I don't ever feel under threat from the ordinary people in Zimbabwe. I certainly don't think I'll have my throat slit as I might in Johannesburg or be shot. So there's this, the people have always been engaged, especially in comparison with South Africa. When you cross the border from South Africa, there's this a nation of extraordinary charm and of beauty.
You were arrested in 2002, is that right? Mm. Tell us what
yes,
happened.
I was.
What happened?
It was after the presidential election. I got a call that they were beating opposition supporters up in this rural area, in this mountains around this village, and destroying their possessions and punishing them, suspecting they had voted for the opposition. And I went down to see what it was, and I was in the process of actually trying to get a comment from an introduction to a ZANU-PF official for fairness and balance. I was sitting in a cafe waiting, and they just surrounded me and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm a journalist." I identified myself. They weren't satisfied. They thought I was from the British Navy and that the British Navy was going to be, you know, invading Zimbabwe from Mozambique. I didn't actually know that at the time, but they definitely didn't believe I was a journalist. Hmm. They definitely thought I was there for a Western government to effect regime change.
And how long were you held?
Only 5 days.
And were you mistreated?
No. Hmm. I mean, it's mistreatment to be in those filthy, decrepit, inhumane cells, which have been declared inhumane even by these courts. They are inhumane conditions, but I was not mistreated. I wasn't abused in any way. I heard people being abused in other cells, men being abused. And there was one policeman there who they've since got rid of who looked after me. I mean, he was extraordinary. I mean, he said to me at the beginning, "Don't say anything. I'm going to see you right." Because not all of the policemen, not all of the soldiers have forgotten their commitment to democracy and the oaths they took of office to treat people free and fair. You know, and he looked after me, but he asked me to make a statement when I came out to say that I had been abused, and I said, "I cannot lie." Hmm. So I tried to just say, I talked about the conditions in the cells, which were absolutely atrocious. I talked about that, and I was a great deal luckier than blacks being arrested, because I was white. I worked for a big newspaper. There was an enormous amount of publicity about it. I could afford a lawyer. The company bought me a lawyer. I knew VOA and people in Washington were looking out for me. But so many people were arrested and they got nothing. I mean, they were just lost. Just lost.
And now you're operating in a country where, you know, political expression is virtually outlawed, where demonstrators are beaten, where foreign journalists are effectively banned. How do you do your work? Can you interview someone openly? Can you file your pieces without censorship?
I just do it because we won. Those who've managed through good luck mostly and some planning, those of us who've survived, and they're very few, there's a handful, who've survived to continue telling the tale, in a way we won some space. They're used to us. They see us around. But you get frights, and then you leave. You suddenly go away for a couple of few months and hang out in South Africa and then go back.
Well, Peter Thornycroft, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Thornycroft lives in and reports from Zimbabwe. She's just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Women's Media Foundation.